masks are still off.
Today is May 16, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we have three work sessions. The first one will be on Senate Bill 65. Second one will be on House Bill 5032, the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Then we'll move and be into a work session on an Oregon Health Authority grant. But before we get started with that, Ms. Ames, is there anything we need to know before we begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 65. This bill has two pieces. One, the first part authorizes PSRB to establish a restorative justice program. That was an agency concept to start with. The second piece is it modifies language relating to jurisdiction over persons found guilty except for insanity. Under current law, the court may place persons guilty except insanity under the jurisdiction of either the Oregon Health Authority or specifically the state hospital or PSRB depending on the severity of the offense. This bill would consolidate all persons found guilty except insanity of a felony under PSRB, and that would become effective halfway through the 17-19 biennium.
So, and with that, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 65 and call up Juliet Britton.
Good morning, co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, Rayfield, members of the committee. I'm Juliet Britton. I'm the director of the Psychiatric Review Board. I'm here to answer any questions you might have in regard to Senate Bill 65. As Ms. Ames said, there's two portions to this, the first of which would establish a restorative justice program in the PSRB program. Restorative Justice 101. It is an alternative to the traditional model in which victims in a public forum are allowed the opportunity to be heard and allows for an alternative to victims and offenders to have a more confidential, structured opportunity to discuss how the crime has impacted them and hopefully move forward in their recovery. The board has not implemented a restorative justice program yet because after creating an advisory council on this topic, there are a couple items that they recommended we do before, one of which is included in this bill, which is to provide some statutory privacy protection. So anyone that would participate in what's called a facilitated dialogue would be protected and knowing that that those proceedings, if you will, would be confidential. There were concerns on the victim side that, you know, it's a very private matter to talk about how a crime has impacted them and they'd want that protection. And then there was concerns on the patient side that they wanted what they said in a restorative justice process to not then be brought up later at a PSRB hearing and whatnot. So this bill would provide that protection. I will note that restorative justice programs are, there's thousands of programs in every criminal justice setting. Department of Corrections even has a restorative justice program. So we hope to move forward with this amendment. The second piece of the bill really was a result of the forensic mental health systems being asked by the legislative body to look for cost-saving ways and to evaluate where can we improve efficiency and frankly save some money. So we as an agency in the forensic mental health system worked with this committee and the Oregon Health Authority to evaluate whether or not in 2017 the need for the Oregon Health Authority SHARP it continues to be needed. So for a real quick summary, back in 2011, the legislature created SHARP. Prior to that, all GEI patients fell under PSRB supervision. And it really was in a response to the belief that the Oregon State Hospital wasn't adequately assessing clients and moving them through the hospital, and as well as the perception that PSRB wasn't conditionally releasing in a timely manner. And what we've seen since then is that we now have the lowest GEI census. There's lots of reasons for that. And in my written testimony, I kind of lay out some of those reasons. But what we're finding now is less individuals are being placed in the forensic hospital, GEI. Sharp now supervises 70. When we turned over our clients in 2011 to them, there was over 125. And we're actually losing GEI patients through end of jurisdiction than we are gaining. So the census really is going down. And we could easily absorb these 70 patients. And I think there would be some efficiency savings, because currently we review all proposed conditional release that SHARP reviews, and so we would just substitute that for a conditional release hearing and maybe even get these patients out quicker. With that, that is my summary. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Questions? All right, seeing none.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go ahead and call up Harris Mattison. Didn't quite print all the way through, but I'm sure you'll tell us when you get up.
I will. I also have some printed testimony, which I didn't see it. Clerk, you're great.
No, I'll scan that in, so they'll have that after the meeting, so I won't hand it out.
Thank you, co-chairs Steiner Hayward and Representative Rayfield. My name is Harris Matarazzo. I'm an attorney. I specialize in working with individuals who employ the insanity defense. I've spent about 30 years doing that. My practice involves both PSRB and OHA, which runs SHARP, the State Hospital Review Panel. I've also been involved in a variety of appellate actions regarding this area of the law, and I'm very familiar with it. In addition, I'm co-authored for the Oregon State Bar since 1994. Chapter on mental illness and incapacity for attorneys in practicing in this area. I'm also an adjunct professor, and I've made presentations to both graduate, undergraduate, and practicing professionals in the area of this kind of law. And finally, I'm on a certification committee that certifies doctors who seek to provide evaluations for individuals seeking to use the insanity defense, so that there's some continuity of evaluation, so we don't get inappropriate people placed in our mental health system. I oppose Senate Bill 65. First, the restorative justice part of it. Although some changes were made as a result of my last presentation, I think it was to the Senate Judiciary Committee, still don't feel that that's enough. We have some concerns. I would note that in April of 2015, the PSRB assembled a task force, which included myself. The initial question involved, does the PSRB have jurisdiction to undertake this task? And we were told yes, that the Attorney General had said that they did. So with that, although we questioned that, with that understanding, we continue the discussion. The group was shown a film with a presentation about restorative justice, and frankly, nobody in the room was supportive of it. A vote was asked for, nobody supported it. A second meeting was held with the same result. There was no support of it. The third meeting, I agreed to join a subgroup of individuals to take a look at the issue. And our charge was to recommend whether or not a restorative justice program would be appropriate for this population, and if so, whether PSRB should move forward with it. The issue of cost was not to be considered. Because neither the PSRB staff nor, frankly, my office, our staff, had any training in restorative justice or mediation, it seemed reasonable that we should get that before going forward. So my office, at its own expense and its own time, sent one of our members to get that kind of certification. We did that. And as part of the that was the first step. The second one was to investigate and determine if there were other organizations or other entities within the U.S. that had similar programs. And we found that there were, in fact, no comparable programs for individuals who were successfully employed in insanity defense. We found, that was interesting and somewhat concerning to us, because this then would be a very new area of the law. We found that, however, in looking at existing restorative justice programs, we found that the success of those programs, we also found that the success of restorative justice programs for those with mental illness, frankly, was unknown. It was unstudied. In reviewing the whole subject, though, we discovered that all restorative justice programs had essential characteristics, including participant capacity. In other words, the individual has to have the mentally ill individual has to have capacity to participate, confidentiality, voluntary participation, cooperation without impact on the individual's sentence. In other words, that they shouldn't get a lighter or heavier sentence depending on whether or not they participate in the program, and that there be an appropriate screening of the parties so that people who participate actually are able to participate and do so in a manner that won't either harm their participants or frankly cause a relapse in the individual with mental illness who's participating. The key obstacles we identified to a restorative justice program for PSRB included confidentiality, and again, I think based on my testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee a month or two ago, some of that's been taken care of, but frankly, I'm not satisfied. Currently, the PSRB allows, and actually it's by statute, that victim impact statements are allowed to occur after hearings, which seems only fair. One of the concerns I think that we had was that information gleaned through restorative justice programs could be used by inappropriately used by victims in PSRB hearings, and that that frankly is contrary to the restorative justice model. PSRB staff would also need to maintain restorative justice records, and they would have to be kept separate from board members. I have a concern. I can't say it's the group's concern, but my concern after 30 years of doing this is that some of those records, some of those things can be very porous. The way the board is set up, which is very different than Sharp, is that the board staff, specifically the board's executive director, can meet with members of the board in their confidential deliberations. And frankly, that person, no matter who it is, has access to all sorts of information, which often isn't in the record. That's an ongoing concern for us. We don't want any bleed through of information to the board that is confidential. Procedural justice requires that decision makers be viewed as unbiased, consistent, and neutral. And as a subgroup, we were concerned that the PSRB, which in fact determines the length of sentence, in other words, how long somebody should stay in the hospital or whether or not they should be discharged, that also giving them any oversight of a restorative justice program would be, again, contrary to the restorative justice principles. Voluntary participation, no impact on sentence, was another issue, and that is that individuals, some of my clients who might choose to participate or not participate, there's a concern that that may impact their sentence under PSRB. The subgroup made some suggestions to address the impediments that I've just announced. One is that because the Oregon State Hospital, frankly, already runs a program very similar to a restorative justice program, and that they have therapists there, they're set up for record confidentiality, and so on and so forth. We believe that the Oregon State Hospital itself would be a very good place for this to occur. The Department of Corrections also has a restorative justice program, which is already in existence, and again, that would be no cost. Those records would be kept confidential and not part of any, could not slip into PSRB hands inappropriately. Frankly, although we didn't think about it at the time, the Oregon Health Authority, the SHARP, the State Hospital Review Panel also, I think, would be a very good entity to absorb this if it were to happen. Their rules do not allow for any staff participation in their deliberations. So I have some confidence that there would be no bleed through there. We were told not to consider cost. However, it would be a cost, I believe, associated with the restorative justice program. There just has to be. You can't start a program and there be no cost. I would note that the PSRB is currently seeking to amend ORS 161.346, mm-hmm. which says that their orders must be issued within 15 days of a board hearing. The board has told the legislature this session that, in fact, it cannot. It seeks to amend that to allow it to have 30 days because it's just basically too busy. Frankly, if it's too busy to do that, because this involves client rights and the ability to appeal in a timely manner, then taking on a new program just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I would also note that outpatient hearings, the board used to, many years ago, because when an individual in hospital requests a hearing now, the hearing must be scheduled within 60 days. The board used to do the same for outpatients. When budgets became tighter, they looked at the statute and found that through, as in their words, legislative oversight, they were not under that mandate. So now outpatient hearings can take 4, 6, 8, 10 months to occur. And frankly, that's a cost of keeping people potentially under their jurisdiction who don't need to be. And we think before instituting a new program that that should also be addressed. On the issue of the elimination of the state hospital review panel, it has worked extraordinarily well. I was initially opposed to its creation because I thought it was duplicative and, frankly, costly. I was pleasantly surprised that within the first year...
I'm going to stop there for a second.
Yeah.
Senator Winters.
I just have a comment. I'm glad that now that, because I was one that worked with Senator Pogranski that actually was responsible in 2011. So I'm glad now that you think that what we did in 2011 was meritorious and that it did work.
Thank you. And I'll keep it brief. I realize you have other work
please,
to do. But I'm passionate about this area. I'm coming down on my own time and because I am passionate about it, and I feel you should know these things. Within the first year of the establishment of SHARP, it inherited all PSRB clients that were deemed Tier 2. Within its first year, it found that 17% of those individuals were inappropriate for board jurisdiction, and they were discharged. So these were not new clients. These were former PSRB clients. The second year, it discharged 6%. During that same two-year period, it ordered 100 community evaluations for people in the hospital to be placed potentially in the community. They weren't all successful, but it made that those findings. This is remarkable. Frankly, the reduction in Oregon State Hospital population is due, I think, in great part to SHARP and what it has done. Between 2012 and 2017, SHARP population has been reduced. I found about 71, but I understand it's 70. SHARP has addressed some very vexing issues. It does not allow. The way it's set up, it is certainly we're not concerned about exclusivity of the record. We feel that the panel meets and does a phenomenal job, and we would ask that it be maintained. In fact, I think there's in my mind, knowledge should be maintained. I think potentially it could be expanded. And finally, just in looking at and doing this for many, many, many years, I would say that the population of the Oregon State Hospital is kind of like whack-a-mole. And that is when you take care of one instance, like, for example, creating SHARP and helping to reduce the population, it grows elsewhere. And as you know, probably the aid and assist population has increased greatly. I believe that to eliminate SHARP at this point, it's done a great job. But it's keeping the system honest. There's a perception in the community, both on the prosecution and defense community, that if you inappropriately place somebody at the state hospital, that person will likely be discharged. And so if you don't want that to happen, you better be darn sure that that person truly has a mental illness. To eliminate SHARP, I think, would be to essentially allow the problem to be created again. SHARP has done a phenomenal job, and they, in the system, rather than removing what's one part of a great system, it should be maintained and improved where it can be. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Mr. Matarazzo, I noticed that you testified at both of the hearings about this bill in Senate Judiciary. What kinds of questions or responses did you get from them in response to your concerns?
Well, actually, I had very good questions, especially with their counsel afterwards. Frankly, I'm afraid I was surprised that this bill, based on the discussion I had with their counsel, that this bill actually made it out. I think it made it out the very end of possibility. I think they were. I think there was some sharing of my concerns about the issue, especially of confidentiality. And that these things, we don't even know that, frankly, restorative justice applies to this. In my 30 years, I would say that there's only been one case where restorative justice could have happened. In fact, it happened, but it happened. It was very specialized. The parties were well known to all of us. It didn't involve the PSRB. It happened after a PSRB hearing. It happened at the hospital with hospital staff right there, people who knew the client. The victims were well known. It was a very highly publicized case. It was a phenomenal thing to watch, but it did not involve the creation of a restorative justice program.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Winters?
I do have a question because I'm very familiar with the work of restorative justice, particularly in DOC. And the two components of it, as you know, is the victim and the perpetrator. And actually, across this country, this is becoming I don't want to call it a program, but a methodology that has actually assisted both. I think it's the recognition that both there's injury on both sides. So I'm really on the DOC side, have had some good comments from that side of the workability of restorative justice. And so I'm just trying to, and confidentiality even in that setting is one that is used to make certain that, particularly on the victim side, that the comments and the information that is given is protected, that privacy. And I would see the same thing. Privacy and making certain that that occurs in our system is valid. And I'm trying to figure out how this would violate that, since this particular piece has been put into the bill.
Well, if I can answer that, Senator Winters, there are a couple things. First, because victims are allowed to make victim impact statements at PSRB hearings, things that occur in a restorative justice program, things said by clients could be, frankly, brought up and provided to the board in those kinds of hearings. And I think that's a real difference, because unlike a DOC matter where somebody goes to DOC, they're given a 5-year sentence, in the world of PSRB, and so it doesn't influence the sentence. In the world of PSRB, the judge gives you a sentence. Generally, it's the maximum sentence allowed by law. And then every 6 months, as a PSRB client, you can go to the board and ask for your release. And so the board can, even though you may get a 20-year sentence, the board potentially could release you at your first hearing, which happens within the first 90 days. So one of the tenets of restorative justice is that you not that the participation be truly that of restorative justice and not potentially influence your sentence. And so there's that concern. And I think I've outlined it more in my written testimony, but that is one thing. Now, the other concern I have is, and I think as our subcommittee looked at it, if it's established, we don't think PSRB, if a restorative justice program is established, and I personally am a big fan of restorative justice, just I have questions about using it in this particular instance, that it be run by some other entity other than PSRB, OHA, DOC, the Oregon State Hospital itself, I think would be more appropriate because of the confidentiality, and there'd be absolutely no, I think it'd be limited ability for records to be inappropriately end up in the board's hands or to their knowledge.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you. Chair Rayfield, help me understand the, I'm assuming these are the GEI is referred to as caseloads. When those are assigned to the authority or the Oregon Health Authority, what volume are we talking about? And can you walk me just briefly through what this bill would do as far as process from the court to the assignment? My understanding, currently the courts can assign to the Oregon Health Authority or to the Psychiatric Review Board. And what size of shift are we talking about?
Well, so the agencies themselves are going to be in a better position to tell you that. But the court can make the determination of OHA versus PSRB. They can do that only by the kind of case that's before them. So as a general, so the general answer would be, if it's a Measure 11 kind of a crime, it's probably going to end up in PSRB, in the world of PSRB. If it's a lesser crime, it will end up under OHA. There has been a reduction in the number of people successfully using insanity defense, precisely because of the work that Senator Winters and others here have done in terms of tightening up the defense, creating licensing or certifications for individuals doing evaluations, and so on and so forth. So, in fact, there has been an overall reduction in the use of the defense, and I think that's been a good thing, not only financially, but more important, for those individuals who are truly mentally ill who are at the Oregon State Hospital receiving treatment.
Follow up?
Please. Yeah.
So, again, how many caseloads are we shifting under this bill, if any? I mean, are we mandating that the courts, for all of them, go through the psychiatric review board? And how many caseloads would that be compared to what we're doing
we
now?
We can all call up Ms. Britton, and that way we can get a more direct answer to specific data.
I don't know there's really a way to forecast. I know you'd be inheriting about, the PSRB would be inheriting about 70, approximately, based on the testimony I heard today. And it's really consistent with my records. How many the court may ascend in the future, I don't know. I can't forecast how many people will successfully use an insanity defense, so that's kind of an unknown. But I can say that because of the changes made, including the creation of SHARP, there have been a lot fewer successful ones, and that's a good thing.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Mr. Matarazzo, I appreciate many of your concerns. However, I would say to you that we do have precedent in statute, given the early discussion and dispute resolution that we passed in 2013 to deal with medical negligence cases, for requiring that certain kinds of communications be held confidential, even in light of future public record proceedings, such as court cases. I see no reason why, even if victim impact statements are allowed and they are considered public record as part of PSRB hearings, that the victims could not be specifically instructed and those letters could not be screened to make sure that something that came out from the defendant in those cases could not be excluded. I mean, the victim can say whatever they want about their piece of it. They have that right to disclose that.
Yes.
But I don't see why we couldn't make it clear that they're not allowed to disclose that and then make sure those letters are screened beforehand to make sure that nothing's included there.
Okay, well, I guess my concern is more narrowly focused to the potentially something a victim might say at a hearing about what went on in the restorative justice program, which you can't unring a bell, and that's my concern.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but honestly, Mr. Matarazzo, I think that the world is full of possibility, and I think that victims who choose to participate in this kind of situation are special kinds of people who are going to understand that it's not appropriate for them to reveal that information, and they can be reminded of that before any hearing. I have confidence in the way Ms. Britton and her colleagues are running the PSRB at this point, both in terms of this context and in terms of transferring SHARP back to them. I agree that when it was started, SHARP made a lot of sense. The PSRB was not the highly functioning agency that it is now under Ms. Britton's direction. So I guess I appreciate your concerns, but I think that many of them are more theoretical than plausible.
Well, you're in a better position to make that. I'm just giving you my
opinion. Are we going to work this bill?
We are.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Matarazzo.
Thank you.
Generally, we end up doing the policy and judiciary, and then when it comes down here, we're more about the finances thing. But I appreciate you taking the time out of your practice to come here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for this audience.
And Ms. Britton, if you want to, I think you want to come up real quick.
Co-chairs Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Hayden, 70 patients currently would be transferred back to the PSRB under this bill. On average, that's about 12% of the entire GEI population. About 70% of all GEI cases are either unclassified, which means murders, so that would be a non-SHARP case, or a Class A felony, and the vast majority, with the exception of one crime, is all PSRB. So 70% of the new cases coming in are going to be PSRB anyway. So it is a small sliver of the GEI population that would ever go under SHARP.
Please, follow up to that question, and I was trying to get somewhere with this. So if 70 cases are being transferred and we have a financial impact that is between 1 and 2 FTE, under the PSRB, per caseload, can you give me an average of how many FTEs? It looks like somewhere between 35 and 70 in OHA cases are assigned per person. If we look at financial impact, does that caseload number decrease in PSRB, meaning are there more people per caseload?
Co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Hayden. I think it's important to recognize that we are losing GEI patients at a faster rate or at a higher rate than we are gaining. And so the PSRB has less overall patients than we did back in 2011. And so we're having to have less hearings. So we're not going to necessarily add to our caseload. We have room on our current existing hearing dockets to absorb these hearings.
Let me rephrase it, just last Please. Question. What is an average amount of caseload? You know, healthcare professionals can take care of so many patients in their office, or dentists can take care of so many patients, you know, in their office reasonably. For these types of cases, is a 1 to 10 average, is a 1 to 20, is a 1 to 30? What's a normal standard of caseloads?
Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Hayden, that's a difficult question to answer. So the board does not actually provide the services. The community mental health or the state hospital does. So in terms of hearing caseload, we right now, I think our hearings have gone down maybe 10-15% due to less clients. And so we easily could absorb this with existing FTE. And we've never done a per FTE calculation. But certainly we've had a much higher GEI population under our supervision, and we're still able to have on-time hearings. So we're confident that at least the 70 can be absorbed easily.
No, I want to compliment the director, because in 2011 this conversation would have been different, mm-hmm. and that was the reason why the changes were made. And so I would concur with Senator Steiner Hayward that the actual direction and the work that's being done under the current leadership is a positive one. So I wanted to put that on the record, and thank you for being able to actually make things a lot better. I made my comment earlier about the work of restorative justice that is going across this country, and it's proven to be very beneficial. So I'm supportive of the Senate Bill 650.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 65, open up a work session on Senate Bill 65.
LFO recommends that Senate Bill 65 be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee.
Mr. Chair, move that Senate Bill 65 be moved to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward has moved Senate Bill 65 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? All right, seeing none, motion carries. With that, we'll go and head Senator Winters. We'll carry it to the full and to the Senate floor on our side. We'll start at the very end. Representative Malmstrom, you can carry it to the floor.
Okay.
With that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 65. We'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 5032. Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 5032 is a budget bill for the Psychiatric Security Review Board. You'll see there's a LFO recommendation memo and then the work papers behind that. So we'll start with that, and then we'll go to the KPMs after that. This budget is a current service level budget, funds current program, And if Senate, of course, if Senate Bill 65 passes, it would, in the second half of the biennium, include that change. The budget is an 11.5% increase over the current biennium. If you look through the printout from the budget system, the work papers, and look down the general fund column, you'll see the budget is almost entirely general fund. The current biennium is at $2.69 million. The primary additions and current service level are the base adjustments, which is the roll-up of past personal service actions, as well as the inflation and price list adjustments, and results in a final budget for 17-19 of just under $3 million general fund. One additional comment, which you've heard in the other bills you've listened to, is that statewide adjustments are not included yet. That will be included in the omnibus bill at the end of session. That will include things like changes to state government service charges and AG rates and those kind of final decisions. And that's
okay. Mr. Chair, move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5032.
All right, Senator Sia Hayward has moved the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5032. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries.
Okay, then the second part of the work session are the KPMs. As you have already discovered, our KPM system doesn't always give you all the information you would really like to see, so I'm going to try to annotate a little bit. The first measure that you see on your sheet is actually number two, timeliness of hearings for both adults and juveniles. That has been, over the last several years, been holding at 97% to 98%. And I have, in the recommended targets, I have increased that target from 97% to 98%. For juveniles, the target remains at 97% because there's only 8 juveniles at the moment. The change in one, something, a hearing issue with one, can jump that number around a lot. So it's been at 100% this last year, but 95% before that. Number three, maintenance of release clients. So percentage of clients in the community continues for adults at 99% target. And that's what it's been holding at for several years, and 97% target for juveniles. Again, that small sample causes a little bit of movement in that data. Customer service, number four. If you look back at their annual report, and where you can actually see a number of years of data, you will see these results have increased very significantly for the agency over the last several years. Consequently, I have made adjustments to some of the targets. Availability of information moved the target from 85% to 90%. And just as an example, 3 years ago that was at 73%, then 84%, then 94%. Also increased the target for timeliness from 85% to 95%. Number five, best practices met by the board. That target has been between 85 and 100% recently. I moved the target from 91 up to 95%. Number one, the recidivism rate. It's a system issue. It's sort of confusing the way this is displayed. The bottom one shows what we are proposing to delete. That is the way the KPM is currently structured for both adults and juveniles. On this one, because if you only have a population of 8 and one of them commits a crime, this statistic was jumping around very significantly. So we are proposing to delete the juvenile section of that, but to maintain the adult section. And for the adults, that target has been changed from 0.75% to 0.25%, so one quarter of 1%. I think that's it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, before I make the motion, I would just say that this report, we were having a very different conversation, as Senator Winters will attest. We were having a very different conversation about this
agency 2 years ago at this time when we were working their KPMs, because as Ms. Ames alluded to, things had been in disarray. And the high level of performance on these KPMs over the past 2 years is a testimony to Ms. Britton's leadership. And I know I've said it before, but I'll say it again. Nice work. So I just wanted it. So, Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendations on the key performance measures.
All right. Senator Steiner here has moved the LFO recommendation on key performance measures. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion carries.
Okay. LFO recommends a budget of $2,999,554 general fund, 2,248 other funds, and 11 positions, 11 FTE, which is reflected in the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5032.
Senator Steiner Hayward has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5032. Is there any discussion? Or is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. Senator Steiner Hayward, would you carry that to the,
yes,
the full on the floor? And
oh,
I'll go ahead and.
The last motion.
Oh, sorry, Jeff. Just kidding.
Sorry.
Getting ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Well, we already have agreement who's carrying
okay,
it.
Okay, there we go.
There we are.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 5032 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward has moved House Bill 5032 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, is there any objection? All right, seeing that motion carries now, Senator Steiner Hayward can carry to the floor. On the
yes,
floor.
Yes, sir, I would be happy to do
I'll go
so.
Ahead and carry it to the House floor. And then with
thank
that,
you.
We'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 5032
thank
and open
much.
Up a work session on the Oregon Health Authority, Health and Policy and Analytics, federal grant application, and bring up Royce Bolin and Tom McDonald.
Good morning, co-chairs Rayfield and Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Royce Bolin. I am the Behavior Health Policy Director for Oregon Health Authority.
It is.
I'm here to testify in support of Oregon Health Authority's request to apply for a competitive federal grant. The grant is called Promoting Integration of Primary and Behavioral Health Care, otherwise known as PIP-BHC. The grant is up to 5 years. It's $2 million per year for a total of $10 million. This grant will support Oregon Health Authority's existing efforts towards better integration of behavioral health into primary care. This will be done within our certified behavioral health clinics and does not require any state match. The Oregon Health Authority requests your authorization to apply for these federal funds through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. According to the federal funding requirements, there are three objectives: the promotion of full integration and collaboration in clinical practices between primary and behavioral health, support the improvement and integration care models for primary care and behavioral health care to improve the overall wellness and physical health status of adults with a serious mental illness or children with a serious emotional disturbance, and to promote integration care services relating to screening, diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of mental health and substance use disorders and co-occurring physical health conditions and chronic diseases. Grant applicants must select qualified community programs or community health centers serving an area or population of high need. To this extent, OHA proposes to use these funds to support the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics Demonstration Project. The CCBHCs are designed to promote a comprehensive range of mental health and substance use disorder services, particularly to vulnerable individuals with the most complex needs, such as individuals with serious mental illness, co-occurring substance use disorders, and chronic conditions. Oregon was awarded a federal CCCBHC planning grant in October of 15 and was selected in December of 16 as one of 8 states to participate in the demonstration. OHA launched Oregon's demonstration in April, actually April 1st of 2017. And so far we have 12 organizations as CCBHCs across the state. The planning portion of the grant ended in October, and then we're in the demonstration phase, which again will end on March 2019. The CCBHC demonstration is currently supported through an enhanced federal medical assistance percentage rate of approximately 75.13%. OHA believes the CCBHC organizations have the best opportunity to advance the objectives of this grant. If awarded these funds, the CCBHCs will use the resources to support the integration of primary care services through infrastructure development and direct services. Examples of which include addiction screening of new patients, physical health screenings, establishing electronic health record exchanges, expanding clinic workforce, and wraparound services. The grant dollars will also help the CCBHCs meet the required provision of 20 hours of on-site primary care in the second year of the demonstration, and will fund this service beyond the demonstration period. If OHA receives grant funds, additional federal expenditure limitation may be needed as part of the agency's 17-19 budget. No additional staff are needed for this grant. The grant is due by May 17th of 2017, and the grant period lasts from July 1st, 2017 to July 1st of 21. This grant, again, does not require any state matching funds or maintenance of effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes,
Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just what conversation are you having with the federal agency that are you pretty sure that you're going to get the grant?
Oh, one more time. I'm sorry.
Are you in conversation with the funding agency, and are you pretty confident that you may get the grant?
I think we're pretty confident in that Oregon is seen as a leader in a number of areas, and the CCBHCs are a nice complement to what we're doing. So Oregon added the additional requirement of the primary care services on site with no additional funding, and we believe that having that service will really solidify the integration. So I feel pretty confident.
For questions. Yes, Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. How long is the grant for, and is it a renewable grant?
The grant is for 5 years, and it's $2 million a year, and at this point we're not sure what will happen after the 5 years. There's no indication that it'll be renewable. What's great about this grant is it's 5 years, whereas the CCBHC grants is only 2 years, so this will actually carry forward that work that we've already seen with integrating behavioral health and primary care.
Senator Winters.
Just quickly, where are the 12 locations?
They're located actually across the state. I can give you a list.
Yes, please.
Yeah. It's a good smattering across the state. I was looking at the map, and I can list out the counties that have direct access, and then the counties that will have
partial
access.
Because I think it's important. I ask that because often so many of the locations are either north and down the valley, and so there is, really the desire that we make certain that we've got statewide coverage. And as one who is very supportive of bringing together primary and behavioral health so that we're treating the entire body rather than dissecting, I'm very interested in the locations of the 12.
I think you'll be happy when you see the locations in the areas because they are across the
state. I just
pulled
it up. Looks like you've got, I can't quite figure out your map because they're all labeled differently, but one in Enterprise maybe, or I can't quite see because it's under a map. One that looks like it's in John Day, one in Burns, one in Klamath, one in Medford.
She knows our geography.
Bend, Redmond, someplace south of Bend that I can't quite figure out where that is. Eugene, looks like that might be Newburgh because it's Yamhill County.
couple in the metro area, one out in Scappoose maybe, which is probably the Richmond Family Health, I mean the Scappoose Family Health Center out there, one in Hood River and one in the Dalles.
And then we'll just let the record reflect that Mr. Boland's smile with
I think
proving his point there widely over Oregon.
It would be helpful, though, everybody's not so high-tech, you know, tech as my good Senator Steiner would. But, you know, certainly statewide coverage is a desire I know of, and I see heads shaking up and down on this panel. And what involvement will you have with the CCOs with this particular grant?
So there's coordination between the CCBHCs and the CCOs, so we would just attach this part with that relationship.
Might be well in your summary that you when talking to other agencies that's included, so that we know that you're actually having some collaboration with CCOs mm-hmm. across the state.
Thank you.
Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I have experience with federal grants on the education level, and one of the things that I often think about before applying is, so my question to you was how long and for how much? And so you said 5 years. So to sustain a program, and if you're not going to be reapplying for the same grant, how are we going to sustain the program and keep it moving mm-hmm. forward? You know, what other funds are we going to have in place to make sure that we continue the services? And then if this, that's in case we can't reapply for this grant, how are we going to make sure that the services continue past the 5 years?
That's a very good question. Our hopes is that we will see savings in healthcare by integrating both primary care and physical care. And through that, then the CCOs will want to fund this sort of a model. If I don't have the research off the top of my head, but if you add mental health, substance use within physical, when people are having physical issues, the cost dramatically increases. So I believe that we will see a decrease in other areas by having that integration and the right people at the table to provide the care.
Please, Senator Steinberg.
Thank you. I was just going to comment, and I think this will tie in nicely with Representative Alonso Leon's questions and your comments, Mr. Boland. This is essentially the reverse of what we've been trying to do with our patient-centered primary care homes, especially our Level 3 homes in Oregon, where we often have integrated behavioral health into the primary care setting. And this is just the flip of that, because for some people, behavioral health affects their primary physical health issues. And in those cases, getting the vast majority of their care in a primary care setting with integrated behavioral health is the best way to approach it. For other people, severe persistent mental illness can make it that their behavioral health home is their primary home. And therefore, integrating primary care there allows them to get that care in one location, just as the reverse is true for patients whose primary issues may be diabetes or hypertension or whatever, but have anxiety or depression exacerbating that, or specific life stressors that come up, and they need that on-site social work or other behavioral health help at the time of their physical health visit. The savings that have been demonstrated with the patient-centered primary care home program are extraordinary. In the first 3 years of the program, a study published by Portland State last fall demonstrated $240 million of savings, an average over the life of the program of $13 per dollar invested. And that number actually, as averages often do, doesn't really represent the real thing, because what the data show is that in the first year it was more like 1 to 8, and by the third year that a practice participated in a home, it was more like 1 to 25. So I think that over the course of the 7 years, 6 to 7 years, that we would have the funds, both the initial grant and then potentially the overlap of the 5 years of this grant, we would be able to demonstrate analogous savings. Additionally, assuming that Senate Bill 934 passes the House, which I think it will, we will be demonstrating that we will be increasing the percent spend on primary care, and some of those funds can go to these practices because they will have primary care sites. So I think that we'll have a lot of opportunities. One of the deliverables for the grant, too, is to demonstrate how these can be self-sustaining after the duration of the grant. So I appreciate your questions and concerns, but I think we have the data to show that we have a high likelihood of achieving self-sustainability and significant cost savings in the long term toward bending the cost curve, especially for some of the most vulnerable Oregonians with severe persistent mental illness.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But in addition, we have a healthier individual.
Most important.
I need to, because the healthier individual also makes contributions in other parts of the economic system that we all, you know, care about. And so sustainability, and those are dollars that we're not able sometime to capture, but they are cost savings in other parts of our systems.
Yes, no, thank you, Senators. I appreciate the response. That's my concern, that we, my concern is that we start a program and that we provide awesome services and we see, you know, great outcomes from them, but then not be able to sustain them post the 5 years as per the grant. But it sounds like we have a strong probability or possibility for this, the programming to continue beyond the grant, and that it will give us positive outcomes from both the health perspective and then from the financial perspective that we can sustain it. So I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Senator.
Thank you so much. And Representative Valenzuela, I couldn't agree more. And I just want to say, for example, as part of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, something called the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative was included, which Oregon was one of five demonstration states for, where insurance companies and CCOs gave supplemental alternative payment methodologies on top of fee-for-service to primary care practices. And significant savings were demonstrated by that, not just in Oregon, but across the nation. And as a result, the federal government, CMS, implemented the CPC Plus program. Again, Oregon applied a substantial percentage, the vast majority of our prominent commercial carriers and CCOs are participating in that. And it was as a result of those data and the Portland State data that we gained wide acceptance for Senate Bill 934, which upon its passage this year, I hope, will help move this conversation much more broadly, because that program, the CPC Plus program, only works with practices that see Medicare patients. So, for example, our pediatric practices, which provide such important primary care, don't have the benefit of that. So 934 is designed to address that. I think we can hope and expect that because the data collection in this new program will be robust, that we'll see analogous savings, and that will convince everybody, as Mr. Boland said, that it's important to continue these programs and to fund them in ways that fit within our current CCO and commercial insurance models.
Okay. With that, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Rayfield and Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. I'm Tom McDonald with the DAS Chief Financial Office, and we recommend to approve the request.
Thank you, Ms. Ames.
And LFO recommends approval of the request to apply for a grant from SAMHSA for $2 million per year for 5 years to promote the integration of primary and behavioral health care.
All right.
Mr. Chair, move LFO's recommendation.
Senators,
I don't think it's I need to repeat the whole recommendation.
Has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. I'll go ahead and carry that to the poll. We'll go ahead and close the work session on the Oregon Health Authority grant. Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, the next meeting for our committee is Thursday, when we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2391.
All right, and with that, we'll go ahead and close the workshop, or the adjourn the hearing.
We can have to.